Well, good morning, everybody. This is about 2:31, and it is March 24th, and we're going to finish up fundamentals of nervous system pretty quick, and then go into central nervous system today. Central nervous system, March 24th. So I do have the schedule out for us to look at, and so let's see. Just got done with exam number 2 about a week ago. I think everybody's looked at their exams now, but you can look at them for a little bit longer. Your next lecture exam is going to be April 21st. That is the Monday right after spring break. And also on the schedule, it's mislabeled. Lab practicum 3 is not in a couple weeks, but it is on week number 12. So you, Monday class, you get exam number 3 and practicum number 3 on the same day. Okay, so I want to just say that again. People that have a Monday lab, you have a lecture exam and a practicum number 3. So lab exam number 3 and practicum number 3 on the same day. And some students love that because they can study one time and pass two tests.
Come on.
Okay. Yeah, question. Oh, there's a page sign on the back then maybe. We got a page missing? That photocopy machine. Is it the last page? No, it's in the middle someplace. Okay. Don't know what happened. Go ahead. If your name's not on the sign-in sheet, go ahead and put your name on the back. That's not something that I printed out this afternoon, so, or this morning, so chances are you're still enrolled in the class. Yeah. Okay, so on exam number 3, we've got chapters 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17 through endocrine system. Well, if we look further, all right, so the next exam, April 21st, that's a Monday, so people will get practicum number 3 and exam number 3 on that day, and then I switched it around so that the very last day of class in May 21st, then it's the Wednesday lab that has a lecture exam and a practicum on that day. So I'm not just picking on one lab, and the first two lecture exams were not on a practicum day. Okay, so that's how that goes. Anybody have a question on the schedule? Any comments? No comments. Okay, let's keep going. All right, so I'll put that away, and we're not quite done with nervous system, but then again, I want to make sure that you understand this flow chart that I gave you, right? So it's just a nice concept map of the nervous system, right? Nervous system divisions. What are the two main nervous system divisions?
Central
and peripheral. And what's the central nervous system?
Spine,
spinal cord, and brain. Yeah, make sure you say spinal cord. Because spine might actually mean the vertebra, right? Or the vertebrae. All right, so peripheral, and then we break peripheral down into two main divisions. There is a voluntary division and there's an afferent division and an efferent division. Make sure you know what those are. Then the efferent can be broken down into voluntary and involuntary, but you should know the proper names for those. So if I ask you what is the somatic nervous system, you're going to say?
Voluntary.
Excellent. And then, of course, you know, autonomic is broken down into two. Sympathetic and parasympathetic, and so you should be able to compare and contrast a whole bunch of different effector organs as to what nervous system they belong to. So if I say skeletal muscle produces an effect, it's an effector in which nervous system? Somatic, yeah. And a gland is an effector, autonomic, and cardiac muscle is an effector in autonomic, and smooth muscle, that's an effector in autonomic nervous system. All right, so make sure that you can go back and forth in those. All right, so we don't have conscious control over anything in our autonomic nervous system, just the somatic. And as a matter of fact, the only thing that we do have voluntary control over is skeletal muscle in our body. Everything else is taken care of automatically or autonomically. All right, so I can't exactly remember where we left off last time, but we did talk about the synapse. Okay, we talked about different kinds of nerve cells. Just as a review, what are the two main kinds of cells that make up the nervous system? We have Okay, I hear something that's close, but I almost hear something like neutron. Is it neutron?
Neuron.
Oh, neuron. That's right. Neuron is one kind. What's another kind? Yeah, neuroglia cells or support cells. Neurons send electrical signals very fast, long distances. Support cells just help neurons do their job. Okay, so here's that synapse, and what is a synapse? I think I mentioned it last time. Why do we want to know all the components of this particular synapse? Because it's the structural and functional unit of what? Of communication between cells, right? And in this particular synapse, is this a chemical or an electrical synapse?
Chemical.
It's chemical because the signal moves across the synapse from the presynaptic to the postsynaptic cell as a chemical. What's a general name for that chemical? Yeah, it's a specific name, but I even want to know a general name. What is this signaling molecule? I heard it someplace over here. That is a neurotransmitter, right? And here are a bunch of synaptic vesicles filled with neurotransmitter, and furthermore, you should be able to give me a specific name of a neurotransmitter. Yeah. And that is acetylcholine, or ACH. Nice. All right. And that neurotransmitter is even used at all neuromuscular junctions in the somatic outflow pathway. Okay, and let's see. Last time, I don't remember if I mentioned this, but signals only go in one direction, from the presynaptic cell to the postsynaptic cell. Anybody tell me why that is? Two important reasons. Okay. Yeah, you know, this neurotransmitter can diffuse back and forth in either direction, depending on concentration gradient. Okay. But what cell has that transmitting signal, the signal that can be transmitted from one cell to another? Which cell has it? Do both? Do the pre- and the postsynaptic cell? No, only the presynaptic cell has neurotransmitter, right? So that's the way that signal is sent, not from post to pre. All right, and what's another reason? Receptors, that's right. Which cell has a receptor? Only the postsynaptic cell, right? Okay, so this postsynaptic cell right here would be, it's labeled a dendrite, or it could be cell body. So dendrites and cell bodies have receptors, so that's why we call those the receiving ends of a neuron. Right? And then here is a little bit of an axon, doesn't have receptors, but it has special kinds of proteins within the membrane that allow an action potential to move down very rapidly. So this is the sending part of a neuron. Axon terminus is the sending part. Dendrites and cell bodies are the receiving part. Okay. I don't talk about this so much anymore. It's not in your chapter. Okay, but I do want to mention this, and this you should know. All right, so here is the cell membrane. And if we look on the inside of this membrane and then look on the outside, we notice that the voltage is different. It's different in these two places. And it's really the job of a physiology class to know why that is and what the importance of that voltage is, but this kind of gets you in the right direction. All right, so that difference in voltage is what we call a membrane potential. So every cell in your body acts like a battery. And of course, you know what you do with batteries. What do you do with batteries? Like your cell phone, right? It powers your cell phone, right? So it's a form of energy that can be used by the cell. And as a matter of fact, if that voltage were ever to go away on this cell, what could you tell me about this cell? What could you tell me about your cell phone battery if it was drained of voltage? It would be dead. Yeah, that would be a dead battery. Same thing for this cell. If that voltage ever disappears, then this is a dead cell, kind of like a battery. Okay, so the way that signals are sent, this nerve impulse right here has two parts to it. And I do want you to know what those two parts are. The two parts are what we call an action potential. So it's a membrane voltage that is changing, right? And it flows down an axon. So an action potential in motion is what we call a nerve impulse. The two parts of an action potential are depolarization and repolarization. Depolarization, the sodium channels open up and sodium enters the cell. Sodium is just an electrolyte, an ion. Right, so let's probably just memorize that. That will be good for you to know. Repolarization is when potassium channels open up and potassium leaves the cell. And potassium is just another kind of ion. And since they have an electrical charge, both sodium and potassium, we call these things electrolytes. And probably, maybe you've had electrolytes measured in your blood, or if somebody's having trouble in an emergency room, sometimes a physician might say, hey, we need some lights on this person right away. And if you're helping in the emergency room, should you go get a bunch of lights or a flashlight and shine it on the patient? What are they talking about? They're not talking about lights like I have here in the room. They're talking about electrolytes, right? So sometimes that's very important. Well, it's always important to know what the levels of these electrolytes are, because it determines the electrical properties of all cells in your body, including, for instance, like your heart. So that is very, very important. Some other electrolytes. Anybody want to know what some other examples of electrolytes are? Maybe magnesium is important, chloride is important. Okay, potassium, here's potassium right there. I'm not making you know the chemical abbreviation or the chemical symbol for these different elements, but potassium is K and sodium is Na. And you're probably wondering, how on earth did somebody come up with something so confusing? All right, well, we can't use S for sodium because S stands for sulfur, right? And I don't have a good reason why. P. Why can't we use P for potassium? Because P stands for phosphorus, right? And so these elements really are named after Greek words and or Latin words. And the way that Na came into being is that is called natrium, right? And K for potassium, the first word was kalium. So there is some rhyme and reason to why we call these things that. All right, but just remember, as sodium and potassium help determine the electrical properties of the cell so that it can send electrical information down. Ooh, what is the sending part of a neuron once again? The sending part is an axon. Yeah, what are the receiving parts? Dendrites and cell bodies. Okay, well, here is some definitions, some terms that I want you to know, and these seem kind of trivial, but I do want you to really have a good appreciation of these things. All right, so gray matter is, they're neurons that don't have a myelin sheath around them. Can you give me a name of a cell that puts a myelin sheath around a neuron? A Schwann cell, yeah. And where is a Schwann cell located? You should know, in the peripheral nervous system, right? And that myelin has a white color to it. And if there's a part of a neuron that does not have myelin, then it looks gray, right? So gray matter is just a bunch of nerve cell bodies and dendrites, because these don't have Schwann cells in the PNS or oligodendrocytes in the central nervous system. And usually there's a cluster or a whole bunch of these things together, and so we're going to see that it looks a little gray. Gray matter is nerve cell bodies and dendrites. What's the cortex of an organ? Anybody remember? We talked about it in terms of bone. What's cortical bone? Cortical bone? Yeah, it's that superficial layer, right? The central nervous system cortex, actually the brain cortex, is gray matter, right? So the cortex is gray matter on the surface of the brain. And here is a funny term, nucleus or nuclei. Nuclei is plural. You learned what a nucleus was in terms of the cell, but you're going to have to change your understanding of what a nucleus is, right? It can have a number of different meanings. In this particular case, in terms of nervous system, right, a nucleus is a group of nerve cell bodies deep within inside the central nervous system. So it's going to be surrounded by something that looks white, but it's going to have very nice contrast with a nucleus because it's gray. And remember, what's gray matter once again? Nerve cell bodies and dendrites, so a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites deep inside the central nervous system is what we call a nucleus. Right. Sometimes it gets confused, and I'll point that out to you when we get to central nervous system.
So the right matter is not in the deep, but the nucleus is in the deep.
Yeah, nucleus is deep, not cortical. Yeah, a nucleus is deep inside the brain, for instance. All right, well, that's central nervous system. There is something that corresponds to a nucleus in the peripheral nervous system, but we don't call that a nucleus. We call that a ganglion. So a ganglion is a group of nerve cell bodies in the peripheral nervous system, not inside the brain. And we're going to see where there's a really important nucleus, ganglia, there's a couple of them in the body that we're really concerned with. All right, so we have gray matter that we saw right here, but we also have white matter. Where does that white matter come from? Name the chemical. Myelin, right? So oligodendrocytes and Schwann cells, when they wrap a sheath around an axon in particular, right, we call that white matter. And an axon rarely travels by itself, but there's hundreds or thousands of axons grouped together, carrying information in the same direction. And they're wrapped around with that myelin sheath, so that whole group of all of those axons is what we call white matter. So it's transmitting information very quick over long distances. All right, two more things. One thing, sort of like the difference between a nucleus and a ganglion in the central and peripheral nervous systems, there's a little bit of difference between the central nervous system and peripheral nervous system in terms of white matter. We might have white matter, which is what, myelinated axons going someplace in the central nervous system. We're going to call that a tract. And we're going to look at a couple of different kinds of tracts in just a little bit. So you might realize, well, there are probably sensory tracts and there are motor tracts inside the brain. And you'll learn a couple examples of these. So a tract, where do you find a tract? In the central nervous system. Yeah, and where would that be? Give me an example. Maybe your brain or spinal cord, right? And so you could think of that as like a big table carrying a whole bunch of information. That's a tract in the central nervous system. Peripheral nervous system has something similar, but we call it a nerve. So if you hear nerve, you know it's not central nervous system, it is peripheral nervous system. All right, so a nucleus and a tract are in the central nervous system, a ganglion and a nerve are in the peripheral nervous system. White matter is myelinated axons, gray matter is unmyelinated dendrites and cell bodies. Okay, those are just some really good definitions that you should be aware of. Okay, now why do we have myelinated axons? It's because a myelinated axon transmits that nerve impulse that we see over here on the slide very, very quickly. All right, so when a nerve impulse hops from one end of a Schwann cell to the other, we call that saltatory conduction. And saltatory conduction is very fast, as much as maybe 300 miles an hour. Nobody can even run 300 miles an hour in here, right? But your nerves can transmit information that fast. If an axon is not myelinated, and we got a couple examples in our body where that is, then it is conducting an electrical impulse really slowly, about 2 miles an hour. And we all can run 2 miles an hour, no problem. We could probably walk 2 miles an hour. Well, I'm sure we all could. All right, so which is faster, continuous conduction or saltatory conduction? Yeah, definitely saltatory. And what allows an axon to transmit an electrical impulse in this saltatory way? A myelinated axon, right. Okay, so here's one of the last kind of things that we're going to look at in here, and that is a nerve. And where do you find nerves once again? Central nervous system or peripheral nervous system? Yeah, it's in the peripheral nervous system. And they have a little special kind of structure, not like a tract inside your brain. But here is an example of a nerve. And this might remind you of a skeletal muscle. Because remember, we could take a whole muscle like the biceps and break it down into some of its basic components. So if we take a whole muscle and break it down, what's the building block of a whole muscle? It's a fascicle. Same thing for a nerve. So here is a whole nerve, and inside the nerve we can see bundles of axons, and these are what we call fascicles. Right. So there is a connective tissue sheath around the whole nerve that we call the epineurium, just like what? Epithelium. Right. And then around the fascicle that I see right here, we have the perineurium. Peri means surrounding the fascicle. And then if we look inside of a fascicle, do you see any more structure? Yeah, I see some more structure. Right. And I see individual axons that have another connective sheath around them, and that's called the endoneurium. Right? So endo is the deepest layer, right? And the endoneurium surrounds the whole axon, plus also what? The myelin sheath as well. So the myelin sheath and axon are tucked within this endoneurium. So you got epi, peri, and endo. All right. And what else do you see in a nerve? I've got these blood vessels, right? So we've got an artery and a vein. Right, because these structures inside of this nerve are way too large for diffusion to deliver oxygen and nutrients. So it has to have its own vascular supply. As opposed to tracts, the tracts in your brain do not have an epineurium or a perineurium or an endoneurium, right? And tracts in the brain don't have blood vessels either. Right, so the nerve in the peripheral nervous system is a little bit tougher because it's not protected by the cranial bones, for instance. So that's an important difference. Okay, what did I miss? Okay, that's pretty much everything under nerves. Neuronal organization. We talked about this before. And that is a reflex. What does a reflex always start with? It starts with a stimulus. And it ends in a response. And do we have, there's that initial slide. Do I have another one here to look at? Nope, this is still the best one. Okay, so this glass of water right here is what, in terms of that response loop that we're looking at, or a reflex? This is a stimulus, and of course, in order to appreciate the stimulus, you have to have a receptor, right? So the eyes in this particular case are the receptor, and then that starts an electrical impulse that sends it to the brain. How does that signal get into the brain? It's via what kind of pathway? And yeah, but let's not say sensory. Let's say afferent. Yeah, an afferent pathway into the brain, and then that information is manipulated for your appreciation. So there are a bunch of nerves inside the brain. We call these association neurons. And it takes it to an integration center so you can appreciate what the special sense that you're looking, it makes sense of what you're looking at, right? And then it makes a decision for you, sends that decision out to an effector organ, right? And so what do we call that outflow pathway? Efferent to an effector organ, right? And that effector organ is going to produce a response, right? So it always starts with a stimulus, ends in a response. And what kind of motor pathway is this? I see this going to like the biceps. Is this autonomic or? It's somatic, right? So this is a somatic motor output pathway. Okay. All right, so let's think about this integration center in the brain a little bit. And we notice that there are three main ways that we can classify the way that information is shared and processed within the brain, right? There are diverging, converging, and reverberation circuits. So let me pull up some examples of these things. What do these things look like? Okay, so here, on this slide, I see one nerve cell at the top, and then I see a trifurcation, and then in the next row I see three neurons, right? And then these both bifurcate, and then in the very last row I see six neurons. So here's a signal that started in one cell, and what does this one cell do? It shares that information with three more cells across this junction. What is this junction called? That's a nice chemical synapse, right? And so this is what we call a divergent pathway. So why might this be handy? Well, okay, let's just say that you grab something hot on the stove. And so that damaging stimulus should be shared with a lot of things inside your body. So that that stimulus goes into your central nervous system, and when you touch something hot, it's going to cause a muscle to contract. What muscle do you think would contract if you're touching something hot? What's going to withdraw your hand from that stimulus? Like your biceps or brachialis, for instance. Okay, so both of those muscles are going to contract, so that takes care of the first two neurons right here. But what about this third one? In order for the brachialis and biceps to contract, what else has to happen? The triceps has to relax. Right? So information is shared to produce very coordinated kinds of muscles. All right, now there's something else too that might contract. If you grab something hot or something very noxious on your hand, not only do you withdraw your right hand, but you might do something with your left hand. You might actually push away as well, right? So that stimulus, right, or the decision that the central nervous system makes can involve a lot of different kinds of effector organs. And the way it does that is by using divergent circuits. All right, the next kind are what we call convergent circuits. Where, for, let's look at the nerve cell right at the bottom. How many inputs does this sensor cell or the bottom neuron receive? I see one, I see two, I see three. All right, so here is a nice integration center. What does integration mean? It adds up all of those different signals, right, from these three different kinds of neurons. And I think I maybe mentioned this before. Let's just say, and I talked about a fire alarm, for instance, if they were testing fire alarms and somebody came in and said, oh, you know, we're just testing the fire alarm. You don't have to disrupt class when you hear it. So we hear a fire alarm, so this particular neuron is sending information to the integration center, but we know, we shouldn't leave class because they're just testing the fire alarm. But what happens if we hear the fire alarm from neuron number one and number two, we see the flashing light? Right? And well, nobody told us they're testing the flashing light, so now what might you think? Well, maybe there is a real fire someplace, right? And so this neuron has to make up its mind what to do. It integrates that information. But now what happens if you hear the fire alarm? Even though somebody told you we're just testing the fire alarm, you hear the fire alarm, you see the flashing light, and now you smell smoke from this third input. Now what's your decision going to be? Oh, they're just testing the fire alarm? Probably not, right? Okay, so this is what we call a convergent circuit. So this is comparing a whole bunch of different outputs, a whole bunch of different inputs to control one particular output. All right, here is a very interesting circuit. This is the reverberating circuit. And I can see four cells in this top row, and they're all connected one after the other. Right, we call that just a series connection of neurons. So if we stimulate the input neuron, that signal goes all the way to the output, but it's got to go through neuron number two and neuron number three. And it just so happens in this particular circuit, neuron number three has a collateral axon, right? So here's a diverging signal, and it stimulates neuron number four, but it also stimulates another neuron. Now, what's the orientation of this one neuron in the bottom row compared to the neurons in the top row? Okay, I don't know if I want to say converging or diverging, but which way does a signal move in a neuron? In both directions or only in one direction? Okay, remember, only one direction, just like a synapse, right? Here's a nerve impulse going from cell body to the axon terminus. That's the only direction a nerve impulse can go. And then again, a signal can only move across the synapse in one direction, like what we talked about before, because only the presynaptic neuron has a neurotransmitter, only the postsynaptic has a receptor. Right? But this second neuron right here does have a divergent pathway, stimulates the fourth neuron, but this collateral axon stimulates a neuron which is pointing in which direction? Is it in the forward direction? We're going to call this the antegrade of these neurons in the top row. Look at the bottom row. It is the reverse direction, right? We want to call that retrograde. All right, so this bottom neuron is going to send signals back to the third and back to the second neuron, and it will excite the second neuron and third neuron again so that it sends a nerve impulse down through this top row. And what happens when it gets back to this third neuron right here? Then this bottom neuron gets stimulated again. Okay, and then when that impulse gets back to the third neuron, what happens? The bottom neuron gets stimulated again. and again and again and again. And even this fourth neuron right here is sending a signal to the bottom neuron, right, to send an action potential back to the beginning of this series of neurons. So all we need is one input, and then what happens to these three neurons, number 2, 3, and 4, and this one that is pointing in the retrograde direction? What happens to this thing right here? It just repeatedly stimulates itself over and over and over again. It just kind of rings and rings and rings and rings. This is what we call the reverberating circuit. And that's very important because when you hear your alarm clock in the morning, what happens typically? You wake up and you stay awake for a number of hours due to these reverberating circuits, right, in our brain. And that's called the, you don't believe me, you're going to fall asleep anyway. Okay. Okay, so we call this part of the reticular activating system. Once it becomes activated with the proper kinds of stimulus, and probably all of us know what kind of stimuli wake us up. For me, it's light, right? And maybe coffee. Stimulate this reverberating circuit for me that I can stay up. Now, sometimes some people might have damage to a part of their central nervous system where this reverberating circuit is damaged. And guess what happens to them? They can fall asleep at any moment when that happens. Maybe they're driving on the 405 and they can fall asleep. Okay, probably not in anatomy lecture, but other times, maybe they'll be walking across campus, right, falling asleep. Does anybody know what that condition is called? Yeah, that's narcolepsy. And actually that can be due to a number of circumstances, maybe a chemical imbalance, like we're talking about that sodium, potassium. Maybe somebody had a stroke in that part of the brain, for instance, and there's a lot of times we can't even figure out why that's happening, right? And what is a big problem if you can't diagnose a problem like that? If you can't come up with a diagnosis, well, then we don't know how to treat that particular kind of malady. You just get your driver's license, right, yanked. But, of course, don't hide that from anybody because you could hurt yourself and other people, right? Okay. All right, so that's the reverberating type circuit. What else should we talk about? Disorders of the nervous system. Well, here's one. Narcolepsy we talked about, and multiple sclerosis we talked about. What can you remember about multiple sclerosis? Yeah, a person's own immune system attacks something in their body, and what does it attack? The myelin sheath, the oligodendrocytes inside the central nervous system, right? And remember that myelin sheath determines the speed of nerve impulse, and so when that myelin sheath gets destroyed, then the timing of how events are perceived and processed in a person's brain that is undergoing a relapse of multiple sclerosis is really messed up, and so they have difficulties dealing with that. Okay, so that's it for general properties of the nervous system. So what, if I want you to memorize just maybe four things, right? For sure, memorize this response loop, all the pieces of response loop, stimulus going through a response, and here's an effector. Make sure you know what different kinds of effectors are in your body, depending on what kind of nervous system it is. And probably the nerve right here you should memorize. That's important, but that's not one of my big three. Here's one of my big three, nervous system terms, right? Make sure you know what gray matter is, what white matter is, which of these components you find in the central nervous system and which you find in the peripheral nervous system. And then an action potential. I want you to know there are two important electrolytes important in sending electrical information down an axon. And what are the names of those two electrolytes? Sodium and potassium, right? Na stands for sodium, K stands for potassium. And there was one more, right? This diagram right here. Make sure you can break the nervous system down into all these different components so that when we talk about these components, you know what we're talking about. And so that leads us to the next chapter, which is what? Yeah, brain and spinal cord. Okay, so that's what we're going to look at next, which we have right here. maybe I'll put that away. Okay, so here we have a slide that shows a little bit of the brain and spinal cord. So here's pretty much a picture of the central nervous system. And I want to start talking about the brain first. All right, so what parts of the brain am I most interested in? Well, the brain has lobes, has major lobes associated with it, named after, okay, the bones that they are underneath. So we got five general areas of the brain. So right over here, I see a change in color. So right here represents where the foramen magnum would be. What bone has a foramen magnum? Remember, a foramen is just a hole? Yeah, and what kind of hole is it? It's a big one. That's why it's called foramen magnum, right? And it's a passageway, right? And it's a passageway for the brain to leave the cranium to get into the vertebral column. So anything below the level of the foramen magnum, we call this spinal cord, but it's still central nervous system. All right, right above the spinal cord, this is our first division right here that we call the brain stem. And it's got a couple divisions. This first bump is what we call the medulla. The second bump we see right here is what we call the pons. All right, so medulla and pons. And also, right across from the pons, we have something called the midbrain. So we got medulla, pons, and midbrain just in this location. Oh, and I don't see midbrain labeled on this. Is it on here someplace? It's to the right over here. So midbrain. Good. Because it's all of these different pieces right here. Yeah, the midbrain. All right, so let's go over some of the functions of these things. So it's not only important for you to know where they are, but to know what some of these functions are. The oldest part, in an evolutionary sense, of a brain is the brain stem right here. So there are many organisms that don't have a cerebral cortex or cerebrum, right? Maybe not a cerebellum, but right, all animals have a brain stem. This takes care of most things that we don't have to think about, like our blood pressure and sneezing and breathing, constriction of blood vessels. Dilation of airways all takes place in this area right here, the medulla. So a lot of autonomic functions are taken care of by the medulla, and then it sends information out through a autonomic motor pathway to various organs. Like the heart, it helps regulate heart rate. We call that the cardioregulatory center. It can speed your heart up, slow your heart down. Vasoconstriction, or the vasomotor center, adjusts the diameter of blood vessels. And one of the reasons why it does is to help maintain blood pressure. So maybe you could visualize a balloon, right? It's all pumped up with air. And what happens to the pressure inside that balloon when you start to squeeze down, when you make the volume smaller and smaller and smaller of that balloon? What happens? Could you imagine what happens to that pressure? Probably you can use. Does it get lower or higher when you start to squeeze it down?
No.
You know what? It gets higher. The pressure goes up, 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 and as a matter of fact, if you squeeze hard enough, the pressure goes up so much, what happens? The balloon pops, right? So that should give you an intuitive sense of what's happening with this vasoconstriction. Vasomotor center helps regulate blood pressure. Okay, it's located in this area here. I'll show you pyramids in a little bit, but the pyramids are in this location on the ventral side of the medulla, and these are tracts that share information from the right and left sides of the brain. Now, what is a tract once again? What's a tract? Is it white matter or gray matter? It's white matter. Axons, myelinated axons going someplace in the body. So, here's where some of those tracts cross over. So, the left side of our brain controls most of the right side of the body. Right side of the brain controls most of the left side of the body because those tracts cross over each other, right? And they cross over each other and make kind of like a little X pattern. And if you look at just the bottom of the X, you see like a nice triangle, right? Like a pyramid. So we call these the pyramids right here. Same thing for sensory information. what you feel or what stimulus is applied to the left side of your body, okay, is appreciated by the right side of the brain. Okay, so here is the medulla. The next bump is the pons, and the pons has a couple functions. There are some areas for controlling respiration in this area shared with the medulla, so there's a lot of sharing between the pons and the medulla, but the pons also has another function. It can take signals from the brainstem and send them to the cerebellum. So there's a bridge between the pons and the cerebellum. We can't really see it right on midline, but if we go deep laterally, we're going to see a big bridge between the pons and the medulla. And those things are called peduncles. I'll mention peduncles. That's a weird word, but we're going to run into that a bunch. So one word that is easy to appreciate, and that is relay. The pons is a relay station for sending information to the cerebellum. The cerebellum helps us maintain equilibrium when we're moving. Gives us a coordinated way of walking, for instance, or grabbing things that takes place in the cerebellum. Okay. The midbrain we see right here. And I see two little bumps. Each one is called a colliculus. So here is a superior colliculus. Here is the, what would this one be? Inferior colliculus, right? And there's one on the left, there's one on the right. So there are actually four bumps right here, and that's why sometimes we call these the corpora quadrigemina. Corpora just means body. These four little bodies right here. The superior one is important because it's involved with tracking visual information. Right, so this superior colliculus right here controls eye motions, so that if there is an object, your eyes, and if that object is in motion, then your eyes are going to be really sensitive to that motion, and they'll be able to track it through space. So for instance, if you're a baseball player and you're out in the outfield and somebody hits a baseball and you look at that baseball for less than a second, just a couple milliseconds, your brain can figure out because of the spin and the curving and how gravity is working on it, where that baseball is going to end up. And that's actually a pretty complicated process, right? So that's the job of the superior colliculus. We call that tracking reflexes. And those tracking reflexes take place even though the cerebral cortex is not alive. The cerebral cortex is the part of your body where you appreciate your environment. All the stimuli, right, sense of smell and vision, temperature, hearing, all end up for your appreciation and conscious thinking inside the cerebral cortex. Well, your eyes can track objects even without any appreciation because the cerebral cortex is damaged. And that has actually generated a couple interesting court cases. There was somebody by the name of Terry Schiavo. Does that ring a bell at all? Okay, maybe, and that was a number of years ago already, but somebody that was put on life support, couldn't ever really be determined why this person had to be put on a respirator. Her parents said that her husband beat her up, and the husband says, no, she overdosed on drugs, and they could never really prove what happened. Nonetheless, her brain died. So if someone were to do an MRI of Terry's brain, it just was fluid. There's no brain tissue left, right? And so there's no brain activity because there's no brain there, right? So what can you tell me about a person with no brain and no electrical activity? Are they dead or are they alive?
They're dead.
Okay. I would say dead too, but, okay, the corpora quadrigemina was still alive. The pons and medulla was still alive. It was just the cerebral cortex. All right, so what was the job of the pons and the medulla again? Controlled respiration, controlled heart rate, right? So this person or this person's body still could regulate heart rate and blood pressure. Superior colliculus was still alive. So what did this person's eyes do? Was able to track objects around. That was one of the most important things, I think, in court cases. A physician came in with a pencil and put it in front of her face and moved the pencil back and forth, and what did the eyes do? Look left, look right, just as they should. Okay. So I don't know exactly how long it took to take Terry Schiavo off of a respirator, but probably way, way, way too long. Right? And the husband wanted her off the respirator to collect life insurance, and mom and dad were just, you know, just hated to see their daughter go and didn't want her to die officially. So there are a lot of things that look like conscious thought, okay? But I think it's important to know the anatomy of how these things operate kind of automatically inside somebody's body, right? Breathing and respiration in the medulla and pons, right? Optical tracking in the superior colliculus right here, but that has nothing to do with somebody's conscious perception, which happens in the cerebrum. All right, well, what else happens? Oh, the inferior colliculus right here, and that there are two. Plural for colliculus is colliculi, but so here is just one. Here's one of the, this is a colliculus. I can't tell if it's right or left, but there's one on the right, one on the left. Okay, and this is also important for reflex activity. This helps you localize sound. Okay, because and it only works because you have an ear on one side of the head, and where do you have another ear? On the other side of the head. So if sound comes from my right, guess what ear it hits first? My right one. And then just a split second later it goes and it enters my left one. And this part of your brain can tell that difference in time so that it knows what direction that sound is coming from. All right, so we have four doors in this room, and even, we should probably do an experiment, but you can imagine, we can do a thought experiment. If we were to close our eyes and somebody were to open a door way in the back over there, you could tell, right, that it was a door in the back and what side it was, because that inferior colliculus right here would make that calculation for you. All right, so all of these things, right, make up the brain stem, which is the oldest part of our brain in an evolutionary sense. Okay, diencephalon, pretty much outlined by, there's one last thing in the in this brain stem, part of the midbrain. I see a passageway right here, and it's a canal, and it carries cerebrospinal fluid. There's a fluid inside various cavities inside the brain. We're going to look at that. And this is a canal that takes cerebrospinal fluid from one of the ventricles, here's the third ventricle, into the fourth ventricle that I see right here. The fourth ventricle is between the pons and the cerebellum. And part of the job of that cerebrospinal fluid is to regulate and maintain proper electrolyte concentrations, like the proper concentrations of potassium and sodium in the brain, right? And why do you think it might be important to regulate and control sodium and potassium ions in the brain? Because that helps determine the electrical properties of all of those cells, right? And these are all neurons, and so neurons, you know, they do their job by sending electrical impulses. So those concentrations are very important. That cerebrospinal fluid is made by some ependymal cells and capillaries, and remember, that's called a choroid plexus. I see a little choroid plexus right here in the floor of the fourth ventricle. I see it in the roof of the third ventricle right here that makes cerebrospinal fluid. Okay, so that's the last part of the midbrain, this cerebral aqueduct. All right, now to the diencephalon, which is, I'm going to take a guess. It's darker than blue. It looks purple. Yeah? Okay, nice. All right, so here we have a couple main structures, the thalamus and the hypothalamus. The thalamus kind of looks like a walnut. It's about the shape of a walnut. And there's a right and left one, and then here is a bridge between the right and left thalamus. We call this the interthalamic adhesion. This helps share signals between the right and left thalamus. And the job of the thalamus is sort of similar to the pons in that it is a relay station. It sends signals, and in particular, only afferent signals have to synapse here in the thalamus, and the thalamus then directs it to the proper part of the cerebrum, right, for your appreciation. So, for instance, there is sound information that enters the thalamus, and it takes it to the hearing part of the cortex. That's the temporal lobe. And it can take information and send it back to the occipital lobe, and that's where your visual centers are located. All right, or it can take sensory signals from the surface of your body, right, and send it to the parietal lobe so that you can perceive things on the surface of your body. So if any of those pathways are damaged or part of the thalamus is damaged, then you will lose that particular sensation, whether it's vision or hearing or touch or taste, for instance. Okay, and when we get to the cerebrum, you'll have to learn what lobes are doing what. Okay, so job of the thalamus is a relay station, kind of just like the pons. The hypothalamus, guess where the hypothalamus is? Where's the hypodermis? It's underneath the thalamus, yeah, so here is thalamus, here is the hypothalamus, and there's a right and left one as well, and the hypothalamus, again, is very important for controlling a lot of autonomic activity inside your body, and in particular, one thing that's very important is that it helps control the endocrine system. Most parts of the endocrine system are controlled by the hypothalamus. One important endocrine organ that we see right here is the pituitary gland. And notice how closely it is connected to the hypothalamus. All right, so the hypothalamus helps regulate hormones for reproduction, for growth, for metabolism, for lactation. And when we get into the endocrine chapter, we're going to talk about all of those. All right, the other thing that the hypothalamus is involved in, and that is it has something we call osmolality receptors. It can tell how salty your blood is. And so when you start to lose water, the salt concentration increases, and guess what sensation you have when the inside of your body becomes too salty? Because there are sensors in the hypothalamus. The decision the hypothalamus makes is you're thirsty, right? And then hopefully you can act on that to bring your water balance back up. This also has a temperature center. All right, so the set point for temperature is right here in the hypothalamus. And what is your set point right now? Anybody know what your set point is? Pretty close, 86, but not quite. We might be dead if we're 86. It is what? 98.6. Okay, 98.6, right? And that number is stored right here, and there are receptors coming from all over the body, right, and sharing that information so it can be integrated right here to control the temperature of your body, which is what? Relatively constant. It sure goes up and down, and we could prove that to ourselves, right, if we all just got in a nice line and started running up and down the stairs in a big loop. What would happen to the temperature in our body, and how would you prove that? You would start to perspire, right? And so that would be empirical proof that your body temperature does go up, but not very much, because when you perspire, that cools your body back down, right? And then when you get cold, the hypothalamus says, you're cold, right? You need to stop sweating, and if you're really cold, then what do? You start shivering, right? Okay, that's controlled by the hypothalamus right here. And also hunger is controlled by the hypothalamus. Okay, so there is a drug that just got legalized in Colorado that has an effect right here in the hypothalamus, and that is what? It controls the sense of hunger. Okay,
why people, they get a lot of jet and they get hungry all the time? Is it they relate anything to hypothalamus?
They have who?
No, like a lot of people, they get a lot of depression, like the stress.
Uh-huh.
And they hungry all the time, want to eat all the time.
I understand how that is. Is it just stress? Maybe, but there are probably many other things too. I'm sure it does, but I'm not exactly sure the pathway involved with that. But emotional state can affect many systems in your body by working through the hypothalamus. Okay, so if there is a woman and they're in their reproductive years, they can stop cycling due to various kinds, like you said, maybe stress or other kinds of emotional stimulus, right? Maybe even physical activity. If they're an extreme athlete, they'll stop cycling, and that probably involves the hypothalamus. Yeah, so your mind or your brain is connected, right, to almost every part of your body one way or another, even through the endocrine system. Okay. Some of those hormones that are released from the hypothalamus that control the pituitary gland are called releasing hormones or releasing factors. We're going to get into that in the endocrine chapter, but I want you to hear a little bit about it before we get into that topic. All right, so that's the diencephalon. One thing I didn't tell you about was the reticular activating system. We said it helps, it has all those reverberating circuits. And where is that located? Oh, it's located between the pons and the medulla. Right, that's in your notes. I forgot to mention that. So if there's damage in some of those tracts or the nuclei, then somebody might not be able to stay awake when that happens. Okay, cerebrum. So here is the cerebrum. And this is the largest part of the brain. And the most. And here is, I'm looking at the cerebral cortex. And what part of the cerebrum is the cerebral cortex? What part is that? You actually know what it is. Because what's the cortex of any organ? It's the superficial part. Yeah, you could say surface, but it's a superficial part. So that's why we're looking at the cerebral cortex. And when we look at the cerebral cortex, does it look flat and smooth, or does it look all wrinkled up?
Wrinkled.
Yeah, it looks all wrinkled up. And the reason why it's wrinkled up is because your brain is really large. It's super, super large. And if you just think of it as being flat, okay, it wouldn't fit inside of our skull. So what can you do to something that's really, really large and you want to get it into a smaller space? Yeah, you can crinkle it up, or you can fold it up. So I see a bunch of folds on the surface of the brain. And the surface of the brain is really the processing power of the cerebrum, right? So the more surface area you have, right, the better processing a particular brain will have. And so all of these things do have specific names, but generally, right, all of these folds right here are what we call convolutions. So convolutions, right, just the surface of the brain that has a lot of folding. A convolution just means a lot of twists and turns. And a convolution on the surface of the brain has two parts. This depression right here, you could call that a groove, but we don't like to call it a groove in neuroanatomy. We like to call that a sulcus, right? Like the intertubercular groove, sometimes called the intertubercular sulcus. That's okay for bones, but not so much for brain. So a convolution has one part, which is a sulcus, followed by a gyrus. This thing that kind of looks like a finger right here, that's a gyrus. That's the high point. That's the thing that's poking off the surface of the brain. Followed by what? Another sulcus, followed by another gyrus, by another sulcus. All right. So those things make up a convolution. All right. So here is the frontal lobe. And the frontal lobe does a couple of different things. But you should consider this primarily what controls somatic motor in your body. And what is somatic motor once again? Voluntary motion, so skeletal muscles, right? So the frontal lobe you control your skeletal muscles by electrical activity in the frontal lobe. So if there's damage to the frontal lobe, if somebody has a stroke in the frontal lobe, guess what function they lose? The ability to move a certain part of their body, right? They might be able to feel and understand everything just fine, but they won't be able to move their body to respond to any of those different kinds of stimuli. And there's also an area called Broca's area. Broca's area is important for speech, right? And you have to use skeletal muscles, your diaphragm, to speak, and Broca's area is just a very specialized area within the frontal lobe that allows for language skills. Okay. What else? Skeletal muscle. In particular, a gyrus called the precentral gyrus. Well, I think I want to show you where that gyrus is. Okay. Where is that gyrus hanging out? I just want to look at the surface of the brain. Probably isn't too bad. Let's look at, here's a brain. All right, so what have we looked at so far? We've looked at spinal cord, would be down over here, and then this first bump is the medulla oblongata. Right? The second bump is going to be the pons. Right? And then here's the cerebellum. And here I can see that bridge between the pons and the cerebellum. I can see that tucked away in here. And then up above, we can't see deep inside the brain. Right? So we're looking right at the cerebral cortex. Here is the lobe that we were talking about, which is the frontal lobe, right underneath the frontal bone. And then here is another lobe. What would we call this one? So you know the nomenclature. I didn't tell you, but you know the name of this lobe already. Here is the parietal lobe, right? And then over here is the occipital lobe, and here is the temporal lobe. Yeah, nicely visualized. Okay. So the frontal lobe stops right about here. The gyrus that is just anterior to this sulcus is what we call the prefrontal gyrus. Right here. Yeah. And here is the postcentral gyrus. The precentral gyrus is what controls motor activity in your body. Damage to this area and you can't voluntarily contract muscles. You still might have reflexes, because reflexes involve the spinal cord, but your conscious thought can't control skeletal muscle. And I want to find, here's a better way. Okay, so here is that central sulcus separating the frontal lobe from the parietal lobe. Here's the precentral sulcus, that's somatic motor. The postcentral is for sensation on the surface of your body, not for deep visceral organs. And what separates that is this central sulcus. Okay, and the way that these areas are arranged, we can see on this slide right here. Oh, let's go back. All right, so the precentral sulcus is what color?
Red.
Nice and red. The pulse central sulcus is?
Blue.
Okay, so red is motor, blue is sensory, and if we jump ahead a couple slides, I want you to remember that, because here we have red. What gyrus are we looking at right here? What gyrus is this?
Central.
The precentral, right? And then you got the central sulcus, and then behind it you have the postcentral gyrus. All right, and so we said that this precentral is for motor control. And this part, the surface of the brain right here, controls your face for speaking, for breathing, for eating. So if we were to electrically stimulate this part of the brain, guess what would happen? Even without conscious thought, what would happen if we were to stimulate this part of the brain? What would happen? Would you wink? Would your thumb extend? No. What would happen? Well, your lips would move, right? Your tongue would move around. Because these are the neurons involved with that part of your body. If we stimulate this part, what's going to happen? Instead of orbicularis oris, then the orbicularis oculi might be contracted, right? Or some other muscles around the eye. And then we have some of the neck over here, then here's the rest of your body. Now, if you look at the rest of your body, which area of the precentral gyrus is the largest, right, for a certain area of your body? What about your forearm? Just a little bit. Okay. What about your leg? A little bit. All right, your foot? Not so much. Well, what part of your body has the biggest surface area besides the head? Your hand. That's right, for dexterity. All right, so you have a lot of motion in your hand that can be controlled by this large surface area in what part of the brain? The precentral gyrus. Okay. And don't forget, if the right precentral gyrus gets damaged, what part of the body do you lose motor control of? The left side, right? If the left precentral gyrus gets damaged, then it's the right side of your body that you lose control of. Okay, same thing for sensation. Notice that it follows pretty much the same architecture as the precentral. Right, so here you have a foot. Right, here's some trunk muscles. Hand, a lot of sensation on the hand that corresponds to the hand over here. And then face, right, tongue for instance. So there's pretty much a one-to-one correspondence. And if you take all these body parts, right, and put it together, you get something that we call a homunculus. So this is a homunculus diagram that shows how different parts of your body relate to the cerebral cortex, at least in terms of the motor cortex. And this is what we call a primary somatosensory cortex. And why do we call this somatosensory? Because the somatic sense is on the surface of your body, not deep inside a visceral cavity, right? So it's not inside a body cavity, it's on the surface, and that's what we mean by somatic, on the surface of your body. If it's deep inside of a body cavity, we wouldn't call it somatic. What might we want to call that? Okay. There's probably a really good way, better than that. It's visceral, yeah, visceral somatic, right, or visceral motor. Okay, so, one last thing I want to show you in terms of the frontal lobe, and this is kind of noteworthy because in a lot of anatomy books, it hasn't caught up with modern nomenclature. It's called the basal ganglia, right, and the basal ganglia is gray matter deep inside the central nervous system, as a matter of fact, inside the frontal lobe. But what do we really want to call gray matter in the central nervous system? What's a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites in the central nervous system? Not a ganglion, but a nucleus. All right? So before that nomenclature was established, people used to call those gray areas in the frontal cortex ganglia, basal ganglia. Today you want to call those basal nuclei, but unfortunately people talk about them in either way. But really you should be talking about them as a nucleus. Right? And they control posture, control motor movements, and they can even inhibit, one of the important things is they inhibit muscle tone. So remember, when I contract my biceps, what else has to happen? My triceps has to relax, right? So basal nuclei are important in that. And if that part of your body gets damaged, then what kind of, how do you move? With difficulty, right? You have very rigid motion or very staccato motion, right? Because you can't relax very easily antagonistic muscles. Right, and that's what we see in Parkinson's disease. Parkinson's disease is damage to the basal nuclei where it is primarily a motor deficit in people. They have trouble speaking because they can't relax the proper muscles in their face. They have trouble breathing and coordinating it with speaking. Okay, one last thing about the frontal cortex, which we see right here. It also integrates a lot of cues from our environment, and it helps determine proper social behavior. And that doesn't happen near the central gyrus, but it's in way in front, anterior parts of the frontal cortex. And as a matter of fact, we call that the prefrontal cortex. And this is an important area for cognition and developing proper ways to interact with people. And maybe you might want to do a Google on Phineas Gage. Phineas Gage was a person that had all of a sudden traumatic damage to the frontal lobe, and his personality changed completely. And they really like to talk about this example in psychology classes. So when we come back next time, we're going to talk about Phineas Gage and how important that frontal cortex is. Like, you guys are really exercising your frontal cortex right now because you didn't get up and run out of class as the end of class started. People that act very inappropriate, it makes you wonder if they have a lesion in their frontal cortex. Yeah, let's go over that schedule change. Do I still have it anywhere? Ooh, I think I closed it off. That's okay. Here. 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 With regard to the practicum.
Okay,
so we're not going to have a practicum on the 7th and 9th of April, which is right before spring break. They're going to be the week after spring break, on the 21st and the 23rd.
Okay, so yeah. Wednesday will be 23rd.
Yeah, so you're going to have your next practicum on the 23rd, not the 9th.
Okay, and you said it changes something else down here?
Oh, yeah. Okay, so the Monday lab will have a lecture exam and a practicum on the 21st. The Wednesday lab, only the practicum, because
okay.
You'll be done with the lecture.
So we have it both days, right?
Yeah, but since you're Wednesday, the very last day of class, May 21st, you'll get
okay.
The last exam and the last practicum.
Got it.
You can kind of flip with the Monday group. Yeah. But it's good for you to be aware of that ahead of time, so they don't get caught short.
Cool.